moment even. I realized that Zendaya wasn't fully present in that moment. Where was the sense of building camaraderie with your teammate? Where was the drive? Where was the faith? Where was the love? People signed up for the show for many different reasons, as a passion project, as a way to further their careers, or because they were bored as fuck and their agent got them the gig. Dancing with the Stars wasn't just business as usual for me, but it was a dream job for which I just happened to be compensated. It wasn't some paycheck that my agent landed me. I didn't have an agent, all right? I was committed to the process, not for the tabloid exposure or because it was primetime television, but because it made me happy and gave me purpose. In that first rehearsal, I didn't sense the same commitment from Zendaya's camp. That day, as I was standing outside, Pop strolled past next. Then a kid came along, a little boyfriend the young star was supposedly dating. At her age, the word dating didn't mean much of anything. The girl was dating her career. She was always supremely focused, but now there was a boyfriend who didn't seem to notice me at all. Claire was the only one who did, "Hey, Val," she called out. Then came another manager, a tutor, and a few other members of a 16-year-old's entourage. No, "Hey, Val, I'm sorry I'm late." Nothing like that. I pulled my cigarette out and headed back into the rehearsal room, where the group had set up shop around the music machine. I shifted into teaching mode, which for me is like having tunnel vision. I tuned out absolutely every single thing in order to zero in on what we were doing. The assembled entourage disappeared, and it was just me and her in the room. I was teaching a 16-year-old girl how to dance the right way, full out, 100% of the time. Zendaya would do a step, and I would weigh in with constant feedback, challenging her every move. Again, and again, and again, and again. No, again. No, you can do better. Are we going for average, or are we going for excellence? Learning to dance was not about doing it superbly one time, but about being consistent. We weren't going for okay that afternoon, because Zendaya was a special talent, and special talents had a special, higher bar to clear. The standard was set not by the outside world, but by Zendaya herself, because of her talent. But it wasn't talent that would allow her to succeed. Rather, it was her desire to fulfill that talent to the best of her ability. "You're gonna give me 10 of those steps perfectly," I told her, "because it's not about greatness every once in a while, or only sometimes, but it's about greatness every single time." I clapped my hands for emphasis. Every single time. The room around us fell silent. Collectively, Zendaya and her people realized that this was not some silly dance show that they signed up for, and that I wasn't just another Hollywood kid who knew how to dance and choreograph. This was not even just about her learning how to ballroom dance at all. It was more than that. Somebody was holding her accountable, creating an environment where she could truly grow and learn and become the very best version of herself. I understood what a vital part of the equation parents were, because I had encountered the situation again and again at Rising Stars. I was a product of an environment where my own parents had meant everything to my development as a dancer. What the world saw that season, and ultimately what I'm most proud of, was how passionate I could be about working with young talent, how driven I was, and how focused I was. That opened doors to a whole different slew of fans, young fans, yes, but also older people to whom I showed a completely different emotional palette and a completely different style. Being paired with a young partner helped me by taking the whole idea of romantic melodrama totally off the table. Instead of questions like, "Are you guys an item?" we got queries such as, "Wow, that was an incredible performance. How did that make you feel?" "How it makes me feel is that I'm proud of her," I answered. "We're going to showcase her dance ability on a whole different level. Showcase her star power on a new level. Showcase her ability to learn something different outside of her comfort zone." During the rehearsal periods, Zendaya introduced me to her tutor. Underage performers in Hollywood have somebody present who oversees their schooling every single day and who also counts how many hours they work. The woman pulled me aside. "Hey, I really appreciate everything you're saying," she said. "You're telling her some really good stuff. Her parents aren't expecting this." The vote of confidence from a tutor/chaperone meant everything to me. By the end of rehearsals, her parents came to appreciate my tough love style of teaching, too. "I wanted to kill you, man," Kazembe told me later. "I'd never heard anybody speak to my daughter that way. Only I speak to my daughter that way. But I couldn't criticize or say anything to you because you know what? That's exactly what I would have told her. You were saying the kind of things that I tell her." We came in second that year, a close but no cigar finish. The hardest thing for me wasn't losing, but the fact that I lost with a partner who was clearly a winner. My message to Zendaya had always been very simple. Work your ass off. Outwork the guy next to you, and the rest of the business will take care of itself. She had done all that, working as hard as she possibly could, giving me everything I asked for and more. But she didn't get the result that I felt she deserved, and it was my fault. At every point between our initial introduction and that second place finish, Zendaya had been excellent. In terms of content for the show and how much I was able to put across as a person, as a teacher, and as her partner, I probably had one of the best seasons I've ever had. And it still wasn't enough. Zendaya and I would dance together again, going on to do many performances in different venues. We're still like family. She became my sibling, my sister I never had. Not just for those 3 months on Dancing with the Stars, but always. Once you invest your heart in a person during that difficult, inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking journey, the bond is forever. My teenage dreams come true. Life looped around and it seemed as though I was always encountering faces and places from my past that came winging back into my present. Some of them uninvited and unwelcome, but most of them a source of head-shaking, ain't life peculiar kind of moments. I grew up watching the NBC sitcom Saved by the Bell, which was already into reruns by the time my family immigrated to the States, but which I could still catch at home even with basic cable. As a newly arrived immigrant, I found that America was a place where you could say, "I was so poor growing up that I only had basic cable." In maybe 9/10 of the world, American basic cable would be a dream come true. Among my friends, basic cable was a source of complaint that indicated a deprived childhood. When people started talking about the shows they watched as children and they mentioned the Cartoon Network, my reaction is always, "Oh, so you had money growing up, right?" Max and I had black and white pictures in our baby albums, not colored ones. We were also poor in terms of the tube when we moved to Brooklyn, but we had access to a half a dozen channels, 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, and 11, plus public television on channel 13. But who wanted to watch that? Come on. PBS? Come on. Barney and Friends? No shade on PBS, since they broadcasted the Ohio Star Bowl dance competition, my second TV appearance after Sally. Don't let the word get out, but at the very beginning of my time in America, I confess to watching a few episodes of Barney. Back then, I Love You, You Love Me, We're a Happy Family was about my speed in the English language. The Big Purple Dinosaur showed me a syrupy sweet reality that even as a child I knew was too good to be true, though a part of me desperately wanted to believe in it. I quickly outgrew him after only a couple of weeks. Saved by the Bell was Barney for adolescence. It depicted the quintessential high school experience that I dreamed about but never had. Looking back, I'm glad I had the type of public school education experience that I did, because I came to understand that the world of Saved by the Bell didn't exist in real life. No one was having flash mob dance-offs in the school cafeteria. But for a quick minute when I was 9 or 10, I thought Zach Morris, his sidekick Screech, his love interest Kelly Kapowski, and the righteous nerd girl Jessie Spanner were typical American teenagers. Along with the shows such as Family Matters, Blossom, and The Wonder Years, Saved by the Bell entered the syllabus of my personal continuing education program aimed at understanding how stuff works in America. These sitcoms might have been a distorted lens through which to view my adopted country, but to my young eyes, they were perfect. I was a sponge, absorbing the nuances of a culture that seemed impossibly cool, impossibly engaging. I don't know if many people today remember the Hollywood catastrophe that went down next. The year after Saved by the Bell ended, Elizabeth Berkley, who had played Jessie, got swept up in a slow-motion car wreck of a movie, Showgirls, that became one of cinema's infamous bombs. Then, a 22-year-old, Elizabeth starred as Nomi Malone in what was essentially an exercise in R-rated softcore porn. The release not only failed at the box office, but it became a symbol of the movie industry's overblown budgets. What the filmmakers lacked in thought, they tried to make up with money. Later on in my childhood, my brother got his hands on a videotaped copy of Showgirls, and I watched it with him, stunned and fascinated to see the girl I knew as an innocent high school character let it all hang out as a Las Vegas stripper. I couldn't believe it. I personified what's today called the male gaze, and Saved by the Bell's Jessie and Showgirls Nomi collided in my head, making for a heady, confusing mix. This was around the time when I first got hard and noticed it, when I first put reasons behind getting aroused. Before that, I didn't even know what was going on down there below the belt. As close as I was to my brother and dad, we never had the bird and the bees conversation that was supposed to be everyone's birthright. We never spoke about sex. Ever. Ever. Even when a Salt and Pepper song came on that put the raunch right up front. I was left to discover my sexuality for myself. Perhaps the old country's ways intruded into our new world household, making it unnatural for a father to sit his sons down for a discussion about sex. Whatever the reason, I never got one. Showgirls was the first film that I remember arousing serious sexual emotion in me. I wasn't focused on the Nomi character necessarily. It was the whole vibe of the piece, how the movie put sexuality front and center. Without apology, it was sinful, and I loved every minute of it. Even at age 12, I recognized there were terrible choices being made by the production team. It stood as the ultimate 1990s movie, excessive and outlandish, though lately it's become a so bad, it's good, cult favorite. Fans now prize the freshness of Elizabeth's performance. But back then, when the entertainment establishment looked around for people to blame for the Showgirls debacle, it passed over the screenwriter, producers, and director, all men, and settled on the vulnerable young female star. The critics lashed out with a vengeance, and Elizabeth got thrown under the bus by Hollywood, demonstrating how vicious the town really could be. The Showgirls controversy receded, but it left permanent scars, especially on the leading lady. She retreated from the Hollywood scene bruised and emotionally battered. She still maintained her place in the erotic pantheon of my adolescence, but apart from a few indelible images that crossed my mind every once in a while, I forgot about the whole affair. Skip ahead 18 years to the fall of 2013, when season 17 of Dancing with the Stars was gearing up. I was directed to an Equinox gym located in Century City, the high-rise development on the outskirts of Beverly Hills where a lot of show business types and entertainment lawyers had offices. The sound techs mic'd me up and I headed into the gym lobby for a first meeting with my new partner. They held me there while I waited for the mystery woman to show. As soon as she did, Elizabeth let out a piercing scream, erupting in joy and happiness, and rushed over to hug me. A conflicted welter of thoughts rose in my mind. I knew who she was right away, but because of the cool, laid-back kind of guy I was, my first thought and reaction to her scream was a single slang word, extra. Meaning way over the top, way too extreme for the situation. But I quickly realized that she wasn't faking it, that Elizabeth Berkley was genuinely excited to have me for a dance partner. My cynicism died and I couldn't help but feel flattered, humbled even. Damn, that feels good, I thought. Let's go. I considered how different this meeting was from my last season when Zendaya displayed an effortless teenage cool, refusing to be impressed by anything. Elizabeth was different, older, wiser, in her late 30s by then. I felt a crushing sense of responsibility. Here was a person who had gotten wounded very badly by Hollywood. But she had put together a great life, married to an incredible fashion designer, sharing a beautiful son together. She had created a popular online site called Ask Elizabeth to help young girls maintain their self-esteem, and wrote a book on the same topic in 2011. Yes, I was a big star, she would tell her fans. Then I did a movie that made me less of a star. Oh, wow, ouch, you know? But I still have a roof over my head, and that one bad thing didn't cost me my life. Thank God, I have a beautiful child. Life is beautiful. In rehearsal, Elizabeth was very good, loved to dance, and appreciated every second of the process. The elephant in the room was Showgirls, but it was a big, friendly elephant, never dark, never aggressive. Elizabeth always embraced her inner Moni. If a fan asked her to sign a Showgirls poster, she held out her Sharpie without a hint of negativity. I said before that I was just as proud of my losses as I was of my gains, and she developed a similar philosophy. If you're going to own your victories, you have to own your defeats too. No one could deny in terms of a movie career, Showgirls was a loss, but a loss that shaped her life and helped make her into the happy, healthy person she was now. I was just enough of an ass to inform Elizabeth that on Saved by the Bell, the Jesse Spano character was never my crush. Jesse was cool, but Kelly was my girl. Elizabeth gave me a wan smile and didn't seem to hold it against me. She refrained from pointing out the obvious. They were fictional characters, Val. In 20 years, I hope I don't get offended if someone tells me they always liked Derek more than me. I hope my life will continue in the face of that withering piece of news. I won't be offended. Well, actually, some small corner of me will probably get offended, but I'll get over it. During rehearsals, I couldn't help but notice Elizabeth Berkley had very arresting eyes. Actually, one eye was blue and the other one was green, which was a rare thing and rendered her gaze absolutely magnetic. She didn't look at a person, she looked into a person. At first, I found it almost overwhelming. Yo, wait, stop. I wanted to call out. Hold on a second. Just hold up a second, please. I felt as though I had let somebody into the living room of my apartment, and immediately they started going through my closets. Yeah, sure, okay, but one step at a time. We bonded over love of family. She had a new son and a beautiful circle of friends and relatives. She told me that she grew tremendously on the show, that there were times, a couple of dances, where she was in heaven with the feeling of receiving the ecstatic gift of dance. At that moment in her life, outside of her son, her husband, and her family, Dancing with the Stars was the highlight. All the pros on Dancing with the Stars choreographed the routines that the judges then commented upon and scored. I've always felt choreography to be the hidden element of the show, with a lot of the truest artistry going on out of sight of the primetime cameras. Choreography is the fuel, some of it high-octane rocket fuel, some of it regular, unleaded. Everybody talks about sleek, beautiful race cars, but not many comment on the quality of gasoline that makes them go. I have zero performance anxiety heading into a dance routine. Obviously, there can be butterflies and all that, but I've been dancing for so long and have competed so often that I know I'm at my best when I'm on stage. I believe in myself when I'm performing, with a confidence that arises not from cockiness as much as from exhaustive preparation. But my insecurities come out in spades when I choreograph, and stage fright attacks me every time. I'm not quite sure why this happens. I've been directed all my life, primarily by Max, but also by other coaches, as well as by assorted other teachers and producers, so that serving as a director on my own can be intimidating. It is as if I were facing an army of ghosts from my past, all the people who have put me where I am today, standing silently by and judging my work. It's important to know that, for me, choreography is not just steps. The gig goes way beyond simply blocking out a routine to include developing a story, a narrative, a vision, and then creatively directing the piece to bring it into fruition. A lot of what's needed to be addressed before anyone steps out onto the floor, because I've always felt that if you didn't take care of the big picture concerns beforehand, a routine could come off as shallow and uninteresting. What is the music saying? How should this dance make me feel? What is the essential dynamic here between the man and the woman? What kind of conversation am I having with the audience, with the couple, with those judgmental ghost armies of ballroom tradition? Dance tells a story. Right there is the root of choreography for me. Because even if the piece has very basic parameters, even if it's, say, comparable to an action movie with a shallow plot, it still has to have some sort of narrative. Not every routine is complex, just like not every novel is War and Peace. Although much depends on the song as well, the story forms a true basis of the action. The algorithm tends to be music, story, dance, in that order. Or perhaps music plus story equals dance. When I perform, my recognized strength has been spontaneity within the moment. The grace notes that I've added made the dance special. Movements and rhythm that were unplanned and unchoreographed. Committed to paper using an ordinary form of dance notation, the piece may have looked just okay. It's the way I perform within the moment that lifts the routine out of the ordinary, simply because I add different layers to it as I go. Imagine a choreographer such as Kenny Ortega of Dirty Dancing, writing down on paper a routine as mere dance steps, using those comical shoe outlines and dotted lines indicating direction. Scribbles on a piece of paper can't sum up what happens in the movie when Baby and Johnny Castle dance. Notation is a two-dimensional description of a three-dimensional reality, or maybe four-dimensional, since the dancers are not just passing through space up and down, forward and back, side to side, but moving in time also. I'd like to take you through the whole process, then provide an example from my season with Elizabeth that shows how it all plays out. The name of the piece is, I really tend to start on that very basic level, and usually the routine simply takes on the name of the song, because the music inspires the dance. When I'm in conversation with the producers, their vision becomes obvious. Let's say in this case, they want a dance that is like a movie. A high-energy, buttered popcorn, in-your-face dance extravaganza. My initial conception might have been different. With the addition of the producer's input, I would have to adjust my vision, no longer thinking in terms of a Woody Allen character piece, say, but now something like Fast and the Furious 10 on the dance floor. I choreograph for different environments, different moods, and different strengths. Let's say the chosen music is an uplifting pop song then currently on the charts, featuring an EDM type of sound, meaning electronic dance music with lots of synthesizers and programmed drum beats. Listening to the music, I would feel the pressure of the song's hype, the artificial inflation that takes place because everyone in the audience knows the tune. A popular song can quickly turn from novelty into habit, and habit can be deadening. But the music is still super sexy and super strong, and there's a very solid male-female interaction running through the lyrics. A cha-cha, I decide. A treatment begins to form in my mind, the story that I would write with this dance. At first, I reference only fabric textures, different colors, the kind of dresses I envision for the girl. I want beaded fringe, I say, almost in a trance, like some poet making a connection with his muse. Pearl gray, no frills. Next, a sense of dim, moody lighting comes to mind. I want solo spots, tightly focused spotlights on individual performers. A very intimate feel in the beginning, I'll probably want a spot on her, and as she moves back, she reveals him. So he'll be in the foreground, and is only revealed as the camera pulls back. The difficult thing is transitioning between theatrical, competitive, and television routines. Choreographing for television is far different from choreographing for theater, which in turn is very different from choreographing for competition. In competition, we always have a standard, pre-rehearsed routine worked out in advance, but we never know what song the DJ is going to play. Every round, we are forced to customize our routine on the fly to match the music. Because I studied the violin, I have a basic understanding of quarter beats, whole notes, bars, crescendos. Those formative years working out on the keyboard at Odessa Music Academy allowed me a general sense of how musicality operates within the context of a song. All that comes into play as I chart the ways the music can intersect with story and be transformed into dance. As the pop song plays, I count out the beats in my head, and watch the dance come together in my mind. Cha-cha-cha, two, three. Cha-cha-cha, two, three. Four and one, two, three. Four and one. I listen to the rhythm of the song. Where is the four and one? If there is no four and one beat, complemented by percussion instruments, the dance loses the essence of cha-cha. Each style of dance summons up different visions. Tango needs instrumentation that speaks of Argentinian dance halls, whispering of silvery passion and red fire. This cha-cha will be as sexy as a tango, I decide. A tango is, what? A man reaching out to a woman. A plea. A proposal. A proposal of marriage. That is enough of a hook for me to hang my story on. I settle on dim lighting throughout the routine because nobody wants to have sex in Times Square. A dancer might kick and jive in the bright lights of Times Square, but for a man to propose to a woman requires a more intimate setting. Drama, mood, the environment, the genre, all of it comes together in my mind within the swirl of music. After I choose the style, set the scene, imagine the costuming, come up with the narrative, consider camera angles and decide on the lighting, then, and only then, do I go back and start putting steps to the piece. I try to freestyle it before I settle on the precise moves, so at least some spontaneous elements can crop up. That works, I say to myself. Okay, let's keep that. When I choreograph, I paint with movement. I have a vision for what kind of dance I want, and the more I think the piece through, the more I start to see it in terms of actual pictures. The magic is seeing what's in my head come to life on the dance floor. Once I have the vision of the piece solidly in my mind, I bring in a rehearsal dancer, and of course she can be inspired in ways I might have not even imagined. But I have painted the picture in my mind, and now I want to see what I was painting, so I have to direct her with movement. No is the strongest word I use when guiding my partner. More often it's yes, yes, I love that. My preparation involves dancing the guy's part myself, choreographing with the rehearsal partner, then moving on to the girl part so I can teach it to whoever would dance the part on the show. Learning the girl part is like stepping through the looking glass, where every day is opposite day. By the time I need to teach the piece, I already have it firmly in place. Even though the word choreography means written notation of dancing, I never write down specific dance steps. My notations run along grander, more general lines. I want her to be fierce and contained, then rise like a phoenix, reborn out of the fire. Next, we head into the studio, and I just dance to the music. When I dance, I see the routine come together in my mind. I want to dance to satisfy the mood, satisfy the musicality, satisfy the story. Once I am happy with the way it feels, with the flow of it, and how we marry the music with the movement, my normal thought is, I can't wait to perform it, or I can't wait to teach it. After painting the description and blocking out the moves, I have to hand the piece over to the producers to make the routine happen. I feel like a mom giving up her new baby to the hospital nurses. I will usually follow along the production process, attending the costume fittings to make sure everything is being done right, and check in with the other departments too, the sound and lighting techs, the director, even the camera operators. When choreographing for television, I'd be an idiot not to be mindful about camera angles. Television places your balls in a vise, compressing the creative process to an almost unimaginable degree. Whether it is on Dancing with the Stars or any of the other dance programs on TV, no one is given weeks to create a routine. I usually have 2 days or 5 days at most. Process falls by the wayside. Trial and error become a matter of more error than trial, and results are judged on deadline. In the heat of creativity, I can't very well ask the few dozen people on production crew for more time. Would you all please stand by and wait while I get ready for inspiration to strike? No, I have to be ready. I choreograph the piece, then teach it to my partner or whoever is going to perform it on the show. At that point, the dance exits the realm of creation and enters the territory of collaboration. Unless I am dancing a solo piece that I choreograph myself, Dance is always a team effort, an act of cooperation and connection. Originality is a difficult standard because I'm constantly influenced by other people's work, ideas, or just their general vibe. Originality and artists come from their own integrity, their own strength of character. I respect the concept of sampling from its use in hip-hop, and I think it's important to be open to inspiration and influence. But I also always feel compelled to add something of myself, even if the spark comes from the outside. It can be awesome to dress up who I am with other people's influences. But at some point, the dance has to be me. I have to make it my own. Over the years, I've pitched a million ideas to Dancing with the Stars producers, encouraging them to push the envelope. In one of my early seasons, I wanted to try a spoken word piece that I wrote, professing my love to a woman. The camera would then pull out and reveal I was talking about my partner. Let me be charitable and say the idea didn't immediately grab the Dancing with the Stars producers. The show had a million ways to say no to me, and rightfully so. But for the first time in that season with Elizabeth, the producers approved one of my wild production ideas for a number. As a child of the 1990s, I was more interested in Elizabeth's Safe by the Bell past than her Showgirls past. I came up with the idea of a routine based on one of the sitcom's most memorable episodes. Safe by the Bell was usually strictly middle of the road and light as a feather, but occasionally it would address weighty issues of the day. One plot thread indirectly dealt with drug abuse, showing Elizabeth's overachiever character, Jesse, taking coffee pills to stay awake in order to study. One of the most famous scenes in Saved by the Bell had Jesse dozing off after a caffeine-fueled homework binge. Zach Morris popped through the window. It was a second-floor window, so who was he, Tarzan? Saying, "Hey, Jesse." She woke up and freaked. "Oh my God, no, no." She grabbed the pills and started gobbling them down, behaving like a mad woman. "Wait, wait, what are you doing?" Zach asked. "I need the pills. I need some pills to stay awake for the dance." He was there to tell her that she had already overslept and missed the dance. "I'm so excited. I'm so excited," she repeated frantically. Zach grabbed her and held her. "Jesse," he said. "I'm so scared," she whispered, and then started to cry. The coffee pills episode wasn't exactly a 60 minutes exposé on drug use, but it represented a big moment on Saved by the Bell. People talked about it. For a brief second, it was a thing, a cutting-edge TV moment. Dancing with the Stars liked to do most memorable year theme nights, and for Elizabeth, they chose 1990, when her sitcom star was at its brightest. The producers recreated the whole Saved by the Bell set. In the live performance, I played the Zach Morris character, jumping into the scene out of nowhere. Not little Potsy on Happy Days anymore. "Hey, what are you doing? We've got a jive." "Oh my God," Elizabeth said in character as Jesse Spano. "I need my jive pills." "Whoa, you don't need any jive pills." "I need my jive pills. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared." I tossed her pills away and bam, the song "I'm So Excited" came on and we exploded into the jive number. This wasn't by any means the gorgeous Mandy Moore choreographed opening sequence of La La Land or Kenny Ortega's classic Dirty Dancing numbers, but it was a great moment for Dancing with the Stars because the show brought back a famous, really special moment. And it was a great moment for me too. Reliving my 9-year-old self sitting on a couch at home on West Street and Avenue Z in Brooklyn watching Saved by the Bell, then years later being on live television recreating a scene with a girl of my adolescent dreams. The season after I partnered with Elizabeth was, as they say, deja vu all over again. Someone had inadvertently pushed the repeat button. This time, I went into the first meeting with my new partner to find yet another female icon from my youth. Danica McKellar had played Winnie Cooper on The Wonder Years and was etched in my mind the same way Elizabeth had been, with a way-back sitcom laser. But the journey we took on the show during season 18 was entirely different. Danica hadn't wasted time sulking over the adult difficulties of a former child star, but instead had developed into a real brainiac, an author, an education advocate, and a champion of getting young girls involved in math and science. I was having self-esteem problems of my own. Well, not really. I never have self-esteem problems, but I did have an internal struggle. I knew I was really putting in the effort on Dancing with the Stars, but I had never been able to grab a Mirrorball trophy. What was going on? What was I doing wrong? Now matched with Danica, I was in my sixth season. With previous partners, I had placed 11th, 10th, 3rd, and 2nd. And in the previous season with Elizabeth, we had come in 6th. I struggled to validate my presence on the show. All this effort was meaningless without at least one first place finish. Just one. Just one to say I was able to do it all the way to the end. I wanted a championship year, creating such an incredible platform for my partner that we stole the show and took the season. The choices that I made on her behalf would finally prove good enough for me to give my partner a Dancing with the Stars trophy. If I couldn't do that, what was I doing? I began to ask myself a fundamental question. Was it better to have a partner who knew how to dance or one who had never stood on a dance floor? Both options represented a challenge. If my partner could dance, there existed the challenge of living up to her potential. She could dance, the audience knew she could dance, but she still had to show me her growth. Being on Dancing with the Stars wasn't like creating a music video. It wasn't a single little performance. It was a 3-month journey, for lack of a better word. In order to make it work, my partner had to not just show up, but also learn the material and execute. Show up, fall in love with the steps, become comfortable with me as her partner. Essentially, I had to make her fall in love so that she knew to trust me. The process involved opening herself up, emerging out of herself into a new reality. Otherwise, she shouldn't take the plunge to begin with. To me as a choreographer, the challenge with an accomplished dancer was to develop routines that would test her. With a dance veteran like Elizabeth Berkley, who was excited to be on the show, who had the eyes of countless people on her, how could I raise the bar high enough? My task was to make this the most incredible experience my partner would ever have. Was that too ambitious? Perhaps. But it was always what I was going for. My approach encompassed the whole package, her as an athlete, her as a human being, and her as a dancer. I wanted to see her change physically and emotionally. Her train of thought, inspiration, feeling, how she saw the world. I wanted her to end up with a whole new aura around her. Becoming a better dancer was only number 3 in the formula, at least in terms of what inspired me when I walked into the studio. If my partner already had dance experience, yes, of course that made my life much easier. But dance was still only 3rd in line among my priorities as a coach and mentor, behind athletic qualities and human character. So having dance experience helped, but it wasn't the main concern. With a person such as Danica who hadn't danced much before, the challenge was simpler. Everyone loves an underdog story, but just because I was teaching her dance at a most basic level didn't make the other elements in the formula go away. I still wanted to challenge her as an athlete and as a human being. That, for me, was what the Dancing with the Stars trophy measures. How much have I helped this individual develop in the last 3 months? How much has she grown? I've learned a startling lesson on the show. Audience members have displayed an uncanny ability to recognize personal growth on the part of the contestants. I didn't believe it at first, but the results had proved it to be true season after season, year after year. It's a little odd, but the voters don't necessarily reward the best dancer. They have tended to support the person who has grown most significantly over the course of the season. That fact has reinforced my faith in my fellow human beings. It turned out that many people felt as I did, that what was important in life, finally, was not the glitz and the glamour and the flashy step, but growth. I've read surveys about what children enjoy most about participating in sports. Surprisingly, winning doesn't even make the top 5. Number 1, getting better at the skills involved. In other words, growth. That is what makes people happiest. Not only children, but adults too. The sense of achieving, improving, growing. That also happens to be the quality that most impresses the audience watching Dancing with the Stars. These seasons with Elizabeth and Danica were where I built a whole new relationship with dance. From a very young age, the reality had been I always looked at dance as a sport. I thought that if I wasn't winning, what was I doing there? The kids answering those surveys had it all over me, since they understood the truth of why we do what we do much better than I did back then. I had an interview when I was 15, after winning the Junior Worlds. A journalist questioned me on dance and dance sport, how it was growing more and more popular, and how Russian immigrants were reshaping the international scene, competing and winning under the American flag. The journalist asked me a simple question: what do you like most about dance? And in my Brooklyn accent, I answered, I like to dance because I like to win. Now I can laugh at my young self, but at the time, winning was the major motivator for me. Looking back, I wonder if I would have kept dancing if I had been ranked 48th or 90th or 200th. If I wasn't in the finals, if I wasn't first at these competitions, would I have continued to pursue my life in dance? I don't know. Perhaps I would have gone further in academia, or perhaps the violin would have won me over. There was no competition in violin except for what section I sat in the orchestra. It's significant that I finally abandoned my musical career when I went from concertmaster to last chair in the first violin section, before finally sitting in the second section. The violin stopped being my passion. So in my teenage years, was my goal to be number one or to pursue the art as a means of self-realization, to help myself grow and help the world appreciate the music? Being on Dancing with the Stars and experiencing growth through my work on the show, I built a whole new relationship with dance. Not initially, but eventually. I started to appreciate the healing power of it, the creativity involved that went way beyond the competitive nature of the show. My passion for winning a Mirrorball trophy, I realized, was still my old competitive nature creeping up through my DNA. I could never wholly resist the temptation to want to win. But then the idea of victory began to take on a whole different color and shape. For me, victory without actual growth wasn't worth it. That first win was still an important objective, simply to validate myself as among the greats who ever taught on Dancing with the Stars. But the seasons with Elizabeth and Danica were the beginning of my changing relationship with dance. Common wisdom says that as soon as you stop wanting something, you get it. I was about to test the truth of that concept. Rumor has it. A first meeting moment I treasure came in 2015, on season 20 of the show. But when I explain what happened then, I have to go back and first get into the previous season. That installment of Dancing with the Stars established me as a contender on the show. My partner that season was actress Janelle Parrish, who played this bad girl character, Mona, on Pretty Little Liars. She proved to be talented, ambitious, and a super hard worker. But in terms of the competition on season 19, no one ever gave us a fighting chance, since the fans all agreed it would be Alfonso Ribeiro's show all the way. He was going to own it. The actor and TV host had talked about wanting to do Dancing with the Stars for a long, long time, and he was perfect for it. The producers paired Alfonso with a professional dancer named Whitney Carson. She'd appeared on So You Think You Could Dance when she was just 18 years old and had been a troupe dancer on Stars for multiple seasons before. Whitney was a bubbly, wholesome, girl-next-door beauty, so red-blooded American that when she came on TV, you could almost see an eagle fly by gripping the stars and stripes in his beak. Alfonso and Whitney. The viewers all thought the couple already had the Mirrorball all sewn up. The rest of us could just go home. But I was telling myself, man, fuck that. I look forward to a great season with Janelle. I swore that I would give the two of us the absolute finest, absolute toughest fighting chance that I possibly could. We're going to go down swinging, I said. We're going for the upset. Looking back at that season, I still believe I created the best choreography, best performances, and some of the best content that I have ever produced on the show. I wasn't the only person who had a hand in creating what I did, of course. Family and friends supported me and helped the whole process immensely. Janelle and I made it to the finals and wound up taking third. Purely in terms of performance, the final product was outstanding. Season 19 had turned out well, but something happened in the aftermath that left a sour taste in my mouth. Particularly in partner dancing, what makes a performance so incredible was the same quality that makes the preparation hard to bear. Rehearsals can be exhausting, and the season with Janelle was no different. Gradually, all the interactions between us took a highly personal flavor. We entered into a romance of some sort. As happens all the time in ballroom, essentially Janelle fell in love with her dance partner, and her dance teacher, that would be me, was too weak, too stupid, and too trophy hungry to take her aside and tell her, hey, I'm really not interested in this. I just want to dance. If I had been a wiser man, that's what I would have said. But I was too blinded by the opportunity to play at romance in order to achieve the goal I wanted, which was holding up a mirror ball trophy at the end of that season. I fell into the trap of letting relationship melodrama get in the way of me sticking to the script, which was to focus on dance. I let the line get blurred. I didn't separate the personal from the work. The reason I came to look at season 19 as disappointing wasn't a result of the content or not winning, but that what appeared to matter was the romance, not the performances. I wound up feeling empty about the effort I had put in creating the experience and crafting an environment to help the two of us succeed. I had always enjoyed a great performance, and obviously I can't have a performance without my partner. Janelle reciprocated every effort that I made, but at the end of the season, she seemed to be more concerned about our relationship than excited about the great dances we had created. The flashes of artistic lightning that we had managed to catch in a bottle. For me, the heart of the show was always the dance. Ballroom is intimate enough, so I don't need to have sex with my partner to dance the way I do. When I dance, I'm in the moment. And in the moment, I'm in love. The person I'm dancing with is the most important person in my life. For the moment. Because of that, because I pack into every routine as much passion, nuance, and commitment as I possibly can, the audience inevitably feels the intimacy. For a man to approach a woman in the way I do when I perform, it's almost inevitable that people are going to conclude that we're having sex in real life. Since the only time two people come together with such high volume of passion and comfort and turmoil is if they are in a physical relationship. A good dancer can display a wide variety of emotions. I don't have to be intimate with a person to create a passionate performance. In fact, being intimate, actually being sexually involved off the dance floor can wind up being counterproductive. When you long for intimacy, yearn for it, but never consummate, dance becomes an exercise in catharsis. Complicating matters is the fact that there are usually other people involved. My significant other needs to understand the process. I need to work extra hard to make sure that she knows that she's still number one. I have to communicate the truth to her, assure her every day of the week. No, I'm not interested in her like that. No, really, I'm not. I'm only interested in you that way. I'm only loving on you. Dance is emotionally so powerful, with such weight beyond even its essential physicality, that there is no way to prevent conflicted feelings. That holds true for me too. For example, I'm now in a relationship with an incredible dancer, an incredible talent, just an incredible young woman. I'm so lucky to have her, but she's like me in a female body, and that scares the fuck out of me. Every time she performs, a small voice inside me wonders, am I going to lose her? I'm an artist, and I do the same thing she does all the time, and to her credit, she sticks by me without fail. Lately, I felt occasional twinges of jealousy, not because I don't trust her, or because I fear that she's not coming home to me, but because she might share a very special moment with somebody else, and I want all her special moments to be with me. I want to be the only special moment she has, especially on such a high level of emotional tension, and especially when it comes to intimacy. The capizio is now on the other foot. Seeing her dance with a male partner, I have to consider what happens when I perform and Jenna watches. The only solution that I can come up with is to employ reason. Think it through. Understand that what happens on the dance floor stays on the dance floor. Reason has to play a bigger role in my emotional makeup because life is not as simple as it used to be, and love is not either. My girl can get very jealous, but she's a lot better about it than I am. She loves me more than she's jealous, way more. So maybe reason isn't the driving force. Maybe it's simply pure, unconditional love. She challenges me to rise to that same level. Watching her dance with another man, I have to be willing to say, this is Jenna's moment, and I need to celebrate that. I need to celebrate her, because I love her. That's how I know I found the person I want to be with, when we can celebrate those moments together. At those times, I can almost feel our connection growing stronger. When it comes to love, you gotta dance in the big picture as well as the small. Sometimes it's your moment, and you've gotta love that. And sometimes it's hers, and you've gotta love that too. Is the nature of alphas, especially creative alphas, to generate overwhelming degrees of passion when creating or performing. Passion is part of creativity, more addictive than any drug in the world. It's a hard job. You have to dig deep down. It's like coal mining for the soul. The history of artists and their significant others is often not a pretty one. Check out Picasso's biography, for example, or the life story of almost any one of the greats. I'm in love with her. I'm in love with being in love. And I'm also in love with being an artist. Every day is a tightrope act to make sure that those two loves don't send me tumbling off into space. Hollywood loves romance, and in season 19, the romantic melodrama overshadowed all the good performances Janelle and I were racking up. Our efforts on the dance floor were getting blown away by the soap opera swirl that seemed to be all the viewers wanted to talk about. I told myself, enough was enough, man. Never again would I be weak-minded like that. Never again would I allow a romance that wasn't even entirely there to inflame the imaginations of millions of viewers. Never again would I neglect to stand up for my craft. From that point forward, I would strictly separate the personal and the professional. I've always liked the line from the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, "How can we know the dancer from the dance?" Dancer and dance, they're all wrapped up in each other, right? You can't separate them. But going forward after season 19, I swore that everything would be about the dance, and that I'd let the dancer take care of herself. On a bright Southern California day in spring 2015, I was about to roll into a first meeting shoot for season 20 at the Rockwell Theater. I had been to the venue before to attend the tribute program called For the Record about the film director Baz Luhrmann. The piece was a musical that featured songs from his movies. I thought it was so cool. Of his work, the film that hit closest to home for me was Luhrmann's first Strictly Ballroom, a broad comic portrait of the competitive dance scene in the director's native Australia. But I loved his Moulin Rouge too. For season 20's Meet Your Partner segment, the Dancing with the Stars producers wanted me to drive up to the theater to capture the moment they put a field producer with a camera in the car with me. "Do you have any idea where you're going?" the producer asked. "No." "Are you sure?" "Absolutely not," I said. When we pulled up to the Rockwell, another segment producer met me at the door. "Do you want to maybe come in with the flowers?" he asked, offering me a dozen red roses. "No, I don't want to come in with flowers," I said, annoyed at the offer. I learned the hard way that giving flowers casually was a kind of behavior that did not translate well on Dancing with the Stars or on American television in general, much less in day-to-day life. You have to understand that in Ukraine, presenting flowers to people was a very common practice. On a first date or meeting the teacher at school or going on a vacation, any occasion called for a big bouquet. Men in Eastern Europe gave flowers to women all the time, a gesture of respect first and romance second. In the West, it was much more about romantic flirtation. So the fans of Dancing with the Stars always like to mix in a little bit of The Bachelor into the show, playing up the relationship dramas between the dancers. Where the dance partner's an item, had love bloomed on set. Since I'd been caught in that web before, I swore to myself that the new season would be different. In the past, I had been a willing participant in the whole Playboy business. I did the media appearances and had the sex symbol conversation repeatedly. To some degree, I gave into it, but it was depressing to me that my aesthetic might somehow be linked to a kind of pretty boy reputation that would overshadow everything else that I was doing, everything else that I was. Besides, the credit for my physical self is all due to my parents, who gave me these genes. Being a sex symbol isn't even close to what I really hold dear. My thought process, my ability to speak, reason, learn, create, dance, work, practice. Listen, I enjoy feeling good and looking good. I like the energy that it gives a person. But I've learned that if you feel sexy and confident and strong, the way you look doesn't really matter. Your energy is what makes you interesting. The rest is just window dressing. I hear the comments, look at this stud. I mean, he's on point. Do you think I wake up on point? No. I wake up with the same eye garbage and the same morning breath that stinks like shit. I wish my six-pack had magically developed during the night. But just like everybody else, I gotta be doing those crunches to make it happen. You think I work this hard just to be another pretty face? No. First and foremost, I need to be in shape, physically strong, to continue to create on a high level. Looking good is completely secondary to the primary focus, which is health, and the ability to be an artist as long as I can. The paintbrush is my body, and I have to take care of it. That's why I chose not to present my new partner with flowers, because I just didn't want to head down that road again. Previously, my status as some sort of hottie had been pushed front and center, and my personal relationship with partners somehow became more important than the work. I entered into the new season on the lookout for anything that would veer toward romantic melodrama and distract from the business at hand. Outside the Rockwell that day, I tried to get my opinion across to the segment producer. Don't you think the soap opera is kind of shallow and getting old? I've had all that up to here last year. I've learned my lesson. It's not happening again. Needless to say, he reacted with surprise. The kind of reaction I was giving him wasn't even on his radar. How could I not be interested in playing the game? I headed into the theater's green room. The production crew hadn't seen me in a few months, and they erupted in, "Hi, how are you?" There was a lot of embracing, a lot of Hollywood-style air-hugging, the kind that left plenty of open space in between the huggers. By contrast, we Russians went in for the whole body clinch. The producer guided me over to a young woman with long brown hair and large brown eyes who stood shyly off to the side. I recognized Rumor Willis, and I could not help reacting with astonishment that she was present as a season 20 contestant. "Really?" I blurted out. It didn't seem to fit. Dancing with the Stars was great, and being involved in the show changed my life. But I gotta admit that the program was always associated somewhat with a certain kind of audience, with stronger viewership numbers in the rural areas and the suburbs rather than the cool urban neighborhoods. This wasn't what, you know, your typical kid was watching. Like a lot of stereotypes, that reputation didn't always hold true. I know some legendary rappers who love the show. Bun B, who I met through the popular radio show Sway in the Morning, and A$AP Rocky both told me that they watched it all the time. "That's a big show, bro," Rocky said, a comment that gave me the same flash of pride I had getting applause as Potsy in grade school. But in general, Dancing with the Stars was supposed to represent the opposite end of the spectrum from cool. Meanwhile, here was Rumor Willis, Bruce and Demi's daughter, one of the coolest girls I knew in all the world, putting herself forward to participate. I had met Rumor at the Rockwell the previous year when she and Janelle performed on stage in the Lerman tribute. I tried to imagine her life, growing up fast amid the swirl of movie star celebrity. She was not only born at one of her father's film set locations, but her mom had arranged to videotape her birth, so she had come into the world already on stage, on camera, literally. We didn't exactly hang out together, but at the Lerman tribute and later, when she visited Dancing with the Stars set, I got to know Rumor some. I remember thinking that children of stars must have a difficult path to walk. They didn't ask to be thrust into a world where paparazzi flashes were always going off like firecrackers every time they stepped out of their front doors. Life in the limelight couldn't help but put someone off balance, and the track record